Good morning, everybody. Now, here's a poem from Derek Walcott, great poet from Trinidad, I think. So much rain. I didn't get a snow version, sorry. So much rain, so much life like the swollen sky of this black August. My sister, the sun, broods in her yellow room and won't come out. Everything goes to hell. The mountains fume like a kettle, rivers overrun. Still, she will not rise and turn off the rain. She is in her room fondling old things, my poems, turning her album. Even if thunder falls like a crash of plates from the sky, she does not come out. Don't you know I love you, but am hopeless at fixing the rain? But I am learning slowly to love the dark days, the steaming hills, the air with gossiping mosquitoes, and to sip the medicine of bitterness, so that when you emerge, my sister, parting the beads of the rain with your forehead of flowers and eyes of forgiveness, all will not be as it was, but it will be true. You see, they will not let me love as I want, because, my sister, then I would have learnt to love black days like bright ones, the black rain, the white hills, when once I loved only my happiness and you. Try that again. So much rain, so much life, like the swollen sky of this black August. My sister, the sun, broods in her yellow room and won't come out. Everything goes to hell. The mountains fumes like a kettle, rivers overrun. Still, she will not rise and turn off the rain. She is in her room, fondling old things, my poems, turning her album. Even if thunder falls like a crash of plates from the sky, she does not come out. Don't you know I love you, but am hopeless at fixing the rain? But I am slowly learning to love the dark days, the steaming hills, the air with gossiping mosquitoes, and to sip the medicine of bitterness, so that when you emerge, my sister, parting the beads of the rain with your forehead of flowers, their eyes of forgiveness, all will not be as it was, but it will be true. You see, they will not let me love as I want. Because, my sister, then I would have learned to love black days like bright ones, the black rain, the white hills, when once I loved only my happiness and you. So I was actually looking for a different Derek Walcott poem, and I found that one. Thought you would appreciate it. So much of our life runs that way, doesn't it? How do we love? How is it for us when the days are dark? How is it when someone offers us the eyes of forgiveness, even if it's not what we want? So it's funny, with the topic for our practice period, like the heart of the matter, I could pretty much say anything, so that's really helpful to me. Because each of us has our own path, right? And so the idea of the talk is just to encourage us to find our path. But because we also have in the Buddhist tradition, the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, this central sutra, the Heart Sutra, I thought in the course of the practice period we should study the Heart Sutra. But its utility to us is not so much that we're going to become a little more scholastic, a little more knowledgeable, so that when we chant the sutra we can feel like, oh good, I know things here. But how do these teachings, you know, from Buddhism, from Buddha, according to the tradition. Although, as we'll get into over the course of the seminar, it's pretty clear that the Buddha did not exactly write the Heart Sutra. Not literally, but maybe in some spiritual way he did. So this Heart Sutra is actually called that, and it's interesting that in ancient India as today, maybe we got this idea from them, the heart is not just a muscle that pumps blood, right? Somehow there's a bigger heart than that. And the Heart Sutra and the heart of the matter, the heart of our life, somehow seems to have some connection, some congruency. And so I thought I would open our first talk of the practice period by reading you a little bit longer version of the Heart Sutra. It has a little more of a story to it. There are two main versions of the Heart Sutra extant in Sanskrit, a short version and a long version. The version we chant comes from a Chinese translation of the short version. Although now scholars, we could do too many talks about the scholastic stuff, but now scholars are wondering, did it really go that way? You know, did a Chinese guy invent it and then translate it back into Sanskrit? And there was a big controversy in the late 1990s in Japan about this. People were very upset, apparently. Yeah, and not only, partly, just a little aside, there's a theory that the Heart Sutra may have been created in China. And from a sort of enthusiastic spiritual point of view, all Buddhism comes from the Buddha, right? Comes from India, in our tradition, through China, to Japan, to America. And that tells us the legitimacy of the Buddha's words if it comes from India. And so the person who figured out there's a pretty good chance that the Heart Sutra that we chant was invented in China is American and a woman. So you can see, you know, that would have stirred things up in Japan. Because we tend to see these sutras as documents, right? As documents with information in them. Because we live in the information age, we're Western scholastic people. But these sutras are also seen in the tradition, you know, as holy spiritual artifacts as well. As beautiful things to recite and venerate. The sutra itself, whether you read it or not, has a certain kind of power to it in the tradition. So I think we want to explore this practice period, a little bit of that aspect of our tradition too. That as scientific rationalist Westerners, we want to kind of cherry pick a certain kind of sort of psychologically, scientifically valid, you know, kind of way of looking at this, right? We want that. And maybe that is the best for us, I don't know. But it's worth it once in a while to bring up, well, what if awakening was not brought through a psychological, scientific, rational process with 17 steps? What if awakening emerges just from devotion, just from love, just from inviting the sun back into the dark places? And so the Heart Sutra is actually like a little short version of a great vast literature, which is all more or less around the topic of emptiness. So you might have noticed this morning, or maybe you've noticed in the past, that the sutra we always chant first in the morning service, which is the most important spiritual time in the day in our tradition, starts with some sort of confusing statements. Have you noticed that? That's good, you didn't notice, that's good. You're just chanting the words. That's better. You know, like, no one's like, wait, stop! Emptiness is form, this is making, what does this mean? I have eyes. Hello? Maybe you're too shy. But you're thinking, like, God, can we just get through this and get to meditation? I know meditation will help me. So, we need to explore this topic of emptiness, which is, of course, an English word, not a Sanskrit word or a Chinese word, being used to translate some earlier Buddhist understanding of some kind. So we may need to peel the layers back a little bit. And so the Heart Sutra is sort of like a one-page, like, summary sutra for this vast literature. Many different sutras. Nobody even knows how many sutras. Like, the Christians and the Muslims are lucky, you know, one book, you know. That would be really good. We have thousands and thousands and thousands of books, and most of them not translated into English, right? So we can't even access most of it. And yet there's a richness to that too, right? Not being stuck on any one thing. And so the Heart Sutra is like the one-page version of this literature called the Prajnaparamita literature. And that sounds familiar, right? Prajnaparamita. We chant that. But then they went even further. There's also the one-letter version, which you can chant. And it's the first letter in the Sanskrit alphabet, which is romanized like an A. It's pronounced uh. Sometimes it's too sexy to us, so we can just contemplate. Maybe that's enough. We want ah is like the second letter, but no, it's the first letter. So anyway, these two short versions. One version has a little bit of a frame story, so I wanted to share that with you today. And just a few reflections on this idea of emptiness. And I will attempt not to explain too much. Our idea today in Sesshin is not to sort of explain things, but just settle in a certain way. Explore in a sort of experiential way. What is the heart? What is the heart of the matter for us? But we'll get a little more into explanations in the seminar. So, this is the version that actually is recited in the Tibetan tradition, a little bit longer. And we had earlier this morning a few colleagues from the Tibetan tradition, but they're off. This is cool, actually. Donna and Linda, they're off now at Shambhala Center doing another retreat, and they're going to come back later. So isn't that beautiful? Like the Dharma neighborhood, you know? Anyway, so they chant this in their training. Thus did I hear it one time. The Buddha was sitting on Vulture Peak in Rajagraha together with a great assembly of monks and a great assembly of bodhisattvas, and nuns too, we'll say. At that time, the Buddha was absorbed in a samadhi, so a meditation, on the enumeration of phenomena called the perception of the profound, absorbed in a samadhi. Also at that time, the bodhisattva, the mahasattva, the wonderful Avalokiteshvara was contemplating the meaning of the profound perfection of wisdom. And she saw that the five aggregates are empty of inherent existence. She saw that the five aggregates are empty of inherent existence. Then by the power of the Buddha, the venerable Shariputra, so one of the monks there, said to the Bodhisattva, the Mahasattva, the wonderful Avalokiteshvara, how should a son or daughter of good lineage train who wishes to practice the profound perfection of wisdom? Okay, so that's the little frame story, which is left out of our version. So the Buddha is there, like he always would be for a sutra, and the many monks and Bodhisattvas are there. Avalokiteshvara, here she is, was sitting there and had a realization, some kind of a realization. And one of the monks had sensed that, and he asked a question. How do you practice that? So it's a very practical question, right? So this is not a sutra about, like, stuff to know. It's about practice. Sutra about practice. So that's the frame story. And then the Bodhisattva, the Mahasattva, the wonderful Avalokiteshvara, said this to the venerable Shariputra. Shariputra, a son or daughter of good lineage, who wishes to practice the profound perfection of wisdom, should view things in this way. So they should correctly see that the five aggregates are empty of inherent existence. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, in that way, all phenomena are empty. That is, they are without characteristic, unproduced, unceasing, stainless, not stainless, undiminished, unfilled. Therefore, Shariputra, so this is all Avalokiteshvara talking to Shariputra, giving him a teaching. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, no phenomenon. There is no I constituent, no mental constituent or consciousness. Up to and including no mental consciousness constituent. There is no ignorance. There is no extinction of ignorance. Up to and including no aging, no death, no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there are no sufferings. There's no origin. There are no cessations. There are no paths. There's no exalted wisdom. There's no attainment, and there's no non-attainment. Therefore, Shariputra, because bodhisattvas have no attainment, they depend on and abide in the perfection of wisdom. Because their minds are without obstructions, they're without fear. Having completely passed beyond all error and doubt, they go to the completion of nirvana. All the Buddhas who abide in the three times have been fully awakened into this unsurpassed, perfect, complete enlightenment by relying on perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom is the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering. Because it is not false, it should be known to be true. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is this: Tadyata Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhisvaha. Shariputra, Bodhisattva, Bodhisattvas, Shariputra, Bodhisattvas, and Shariputra, Bodhisattvas, and all beings should train in the profound perfection of wisdom in that way. Then the Buddha arose. Some of the Buddhas in the background in deep meditation through all this. Then the Buddha arose from his samadhi and said to the Bodhisattva, the Mahasattva, the wonderful Avalokiteshvara, "Well done. Well done, child of good lineage. It is just so. It is just like that. The profound perfection of wisdom should be practiced just as you have taught it. Even the Tathagatas admire this." The Buddha, having so spoken, the Venerable Shariputra and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, the wonderful Avalokiteshvara, and all those surrounding, and all those of the world, all the gods, all the humans, all the demigods, and all the Gandharvas were filled with admiration and praised the words of the Buddha. And that's the end. So it gives you a little more of a story, doesn't it, than what we chant. And so the Buddha is like blessing this whole operation. Because one of the things that's very puzzling from the tradition about the one we chant is like, where to Buddha? You know, you can't have a sutra without the Buddha, really. So the Buddha is in the background. It's the way it's understood. Empowering both the question and the answer. Empowering both. So it seemed like this perfection of wisdom is a big deal in our tradition. And it would seem like there's some series of very specific teachings to learn about. There are a bunch of lists in there, and some of those lists are abbreviated lists, which we'll get into more in the future. And then somehow you understand all this and some sort of gloss on how to understand what you see and what you hear, what you think about. Somehow when you understand that, you're released from fear. Did you notice that part? It doesn't say you're released from other things. It says fear, specifically. So it seems to be saying fear is very central. And I think as we practice, if we really are honest about our experience, we come to agree. We say, wow, there's fear is there. But as we release from that fear, it seems to be saying, we really wake up. We're really, in some way, transformed. So it seems to have a first part that's sort of like operational, you might say. Some stuff to do and learn, and a result. But then it has a second part with a bridge word, therefore, which apparently is what the word is in Sanskrit and Chinese. Like, okay, therefore, there's a magical part. Then suddenly there's a mantra, which mostly we don't pay a lot of attention to in our tradition. We don't often chant that mantra. I have been to practice places where they chant the mantra. It's not so common. You know, therefore, there's a faith practice. There's a magical practice. There's a practice beyond what we can sort of like operationalize, make sense of, you know, write books about. And that's what I was saying earlier, that there's a sense of all these teachings that's also imbued with that. And like this morning, we also chanted Dharani, the Dharani of great compassion, which a whole bunch of words that we didn't understand, but there's a feeling to that, right? Did you experience that? There's a power to that. And that one's particularly far from sort of rational understanding, because that one's like a Japanese way of pronouncing a Chinese transliteration of Sanskrit sounds that are not even words, said with an American accent. Right? So a lot of layers there, and yet there's something that passes through, right? I mean, one would hope we would have given up on it long ago if there wasn't something to it, you know? Maybe it's just tradition. We're just like, you know, doggedly going along for 1,000 years. It's possible. But I don't think so. I think there's something is happening here beyond what we can make sense of. So we need to try to unpack a little bit this idea of wisdom. What is wisdom? And what, if there is a wisdom, what's a perfect wisdom? Which is a translation of this term, prajna paramita. One of the books I recommended for the seminar, it's a very slim little book, and we should get some copies for the library. Joan, remind me about that. Slim and affordable book. You could read this in an afternoon if you really wanted to. It's a collection, it's edited talks by Thich Nhat Hanh about the Heart Sutra called The Heart of Understanding. It turns out to have been edited by Peter Levitt, who now is a good friend of the Sangha. So maybe part of the beauty of this book is Peter's work. So here's Thich Nhat Hanh's take on prajna paramita. He doesn't even like the word wisdom, actually. So translation, right? Translation. And words and concepts. They run our life, so how do we work with them in a way that's skillful? So here's what he says. Prajna paramita is perfect understanding. Perfect understanding. The word wisdom is usually used to translate prajna. But I think wisdom is somehow not able to really convey the meaning. Understanding is like water flowing in a stream. Wisdom and knowledge are solid and can block our understanding. In Buddhism, knowledge is regarded as an obstacle to understanding. If we take something to be true, we cling to it too much. Even if the truth comes and knocks at our door, we don't want to let it in. We have to be able to transcend our previous knowledge, the way that we climb up a ladder. If we're on the 5th rung and think that we're already very high, there's no hope for us to step up to the 6th rung. We must learn to transcend our own views. Understanding, like water, needs to flow, and it can penetrate. Views, knowledge, and even wisdom are solid, and they can block that way of understanding. So that's beautiful, huh? So how can we sort of let our minds flow a little more? And what prajna does seem to map pretty well to the word wisdom, so how do we work with that? Well, it has a modifier on it, this paramita, paramita. And there are a couple of different ways that they deconstruct paramita. So we have wisdom that's sort of limited, sort of solid in some way, but this is a different kind of wisdom. Two different ways to break up paramita. The first way comes from the word parama, parama, which means the highest or the most excellent, superior. And so that's maybe where we got perfect. Sometimes we say perfect wisdom, but that's even more trouble, right? You know, we're all victims of our own perfectionism, probably without a single exception. Sorry, maybe one of you. I hope so. Not me. So perfect wisdom doesn't seem quite right. So there's another way of breaking up paramita, which is para and mita instead of parama and ta as a modifier. So para means beyond, beyond. Or it can mean the other shore, the other shore. And mita means what arrives or goes, what arrives or goes. So this way of reading paramita, which is, I guess, linguistically a stretch, but that's another treasured part of the Buddhist tradition, is to reimagine words to mean what you want them to mean. But so this other reading of paramita is that which goes to the other shore, that which brings us across. And that's a very famous Buddhist metaphor for crossing into a place where we're not so bound in our suffering, a place where we're open and free. And so this reading, it's not wisdom like a thing. It's wisdom like a verb. What are teachings, what are actions that help us get across? And we can tell if it's Prajnaparamita because it's helped us. Because we're more, you fill in the blank, more whatever it needs to be for us. More open, more fluid, more loving, more kind. Less stuck on something. More free. So we tend to think of wisdom as a kind of a knowledge, and gnosis in Greek is right, a root that's in prajna and knowledge and wisdom. But this sense of knowledge is knowledge as flow, as a result. And in the teachers of the sort of earlier styles of Buddhism, which is a little more in some ways simple and grounded, we have a sort of vast cosmic vision in Mahayana Buddhism, which I really love, and we're lucky to have it. We have Avalokiteshvara, who's a transcendent bodhisattva who can hear the cries of the world and always responds with love, no matter what, you know. No matter how tired she is, or, you know, not in the mood to have rainy weather or something like that, she's always right there. And so we have this kind of transcendental sort of thing going on in our style of Buddhism, which is liberating in a way, but is also confusing in a way, like, because we feel small sometimes. We want to know how to get there, and we can never be Avalokiteshvara, we feel like. So luckily, in 21st century America, we can access these different traditions, see what's skillful. So here's a little from Thanissaro Bhikkhu, who's an American student of Theravada Buddhism, the earlier school of Buddhism. It's a little more practical, maybe, and a little closer, maybe, to what Buddha actually said. Our tradition is a little more empowered by Buddha's love, and a little further from what he actually said and did, maybe. So here's what Thanissaro Bhikkhu says about wisdom. The Buddha viewed all issues as issues of experience. From the gross to the subtle, he viewed our experience in terms of intentional actions and their results. His was a tactical wisdom. He uses the word tactical, kind of steals that back from the military, I guess. And this tactical wisdom applies to all levels of our life. From the wisdom of simple generosity to the wisdom of emptiness and the wisdom of the ultimate awakening. It's all practical, all tactical. Wisdom is wise if it works. So bringing us to the other shore, wisdom is wise if it works. If it makes a difference in what you do and the happiness that results. To work, wisdom requires integrity, a willingness to look honestly at the results of your actions, to admit when you've caused harm, and to change your ways so you don't make that mistake again. See, very practical. What's striking about this standard of wisdom is how direct and down-to-earth it is. This might come as a surprise, for most of us don't think of Buddha's wisdom as commonsensical or straightforward. Instead, the phrase Buddhist wisdom conjures up teachings that are abstract and paradoxical and fly in the face of common sense. Emptiness being a prime example. Emptiness, we're told, means that nothing has any inherent existence. In other words, on an ultimate level, things aren't what we conventionally think of as things. They're processes that are in no way separate from all the other processes on which they depend. This is a philosophically very sophisticated idea that's fascinating to ponder, but it doesn't provide much help in getting you up early on a cold morning, which is like this morning, right, to meditate nor in convincing you to give up a destructive addiction. So I love Thanissaro Bhikkhu. He actually is knocking our tradition a little bit here, but that's okay. That's okay. We need his help to understand our own tradition. And he has quite a few things to say along those lines. Then just a little more from Thanissaro, and I'll close with a few words about emptiness of my own. So we're not going to get that far here, right? We're just listening, breathing, sitting. And we want the cooks to have time to make the lunch for us. He also says, emptiness as an approach to meditation is the most basic of the three kinds of emptiness. So this is relevant to us because we're doing meditation today. I can tell you later what his other kinds of emptiness are. In the context of this approach, emptiness means empty of disturbance or free of disturbance. But in other terms, empty of stress or free of stress. You bring the mind to concentration and examine your state of concentration in order to detect the presence or absence of subtle disturbances or stresses, or maybe not so subtle. When you find a disturbance, follow it back to the perception, the mental label or act of recognition on which that concentration is based. Then you drop that perception in favor of a more refined one leading to a state of concentration with less inherent disturbance. So that's pretty technical meditation instruction, but it's actually very practical, so let's just read that again and say a few words, and then a little more about emptiness. And this also connects back to our sutra, which was saying something about perception, something about the way we categorize and understand perception. So he's saying in meditation, study the emptiness of disturbance, or maybe you could say the possibility of freedom from disturbance, freedom from agitation. And how you do that is bring the mind to concentration. So for us, that's usually breath awareness in the body, felt awareness of the breathing. Bring the mind there and notice how the mind is. Notice the feeling of the mind. And notice if it's disturbed in some way. Some clenching, some tightness. And then he's saying, be skillful if you notice that some sense of disturbance. That this is the wisdom that helps us get to the further shore, in his view. And see if you can notice what's the origin of that. Is it some opinion? You want something a different way? Some sensation? You know, pain in the leg? Some thought of the future? See what it is and recognize it. And then he's saying, when you recognize that, he says, use a mental label or an act of recognition. It's possible to drop it. Possible to drop it. And then this last part is a little more difficult to make sense of. And then he says, then drop that perception in favor of a more refined one, when leading to a state of concentration with less inherent disturbance. So that's probably a whole nother talk, but it's basically saying, the usual way that we think about our thinking and our mind and our experience is maybe a little coarse. You agree? Maybe a little coarse. And there are ways to reinvestigate experience that are more refined, more subtle, so with less disturbance. Less disturbance. So that's wisdom from Thanissaro Bhikkhu. And so I think what's practical and helpful for us today in Sesshin is our idea here is not sort of becoming breath awareness machines and getting like good at it. Breath awareness is such a helpful marker, such a helpful tool, such a wonderful home, and is always with us as long as we're alive. And becoming more friendly with our breath is so healing, and this is like operationally sensible, right? There's studies of this, and they know the parasympathetic nervous system is activated if there's more oxygen and so on. We're calmer. So this is really true. But what he's saying is, it's just a means to an end. It's just part of the wisdom to bring us to the further shore. Then we have a sense of a sort of baseline, a sense of a grounding in something other than just blah, 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 right? then we can notice disturbance, notice what arises, and notice the sort of causality of that. And he's saying Buddha's, the wisdom of Buddha in that tradition, early Buddhism, is just that. What leads to what? What leads to what? You know, obsessing about something leads to what? You know, thinking about this leads to that. And to notice that, and to feel the effects of that, and to feel the suffering of that. And that's what the First Noble Truth really means. Sometimes we misunderstand the First Noble Truth, the Buddha's thought, to mean life. Sometimes it's mistranslated as life is suffering. Too bad for you. Human birth, you're going to suffer. Which is not true. I mean, there is suffering. But the Buddha meant it more in this way. Recognize this reality. Work with this reality. Stop denying it. And if you work with it skillfully, there is less suffering. There is less disturbance. There is more joy. And so this Heart Sutra about wisdom and about emptiness has a lot of dimensions to it, though, more than just practical teachings, sort of impractical, powerful teachings that also help us. And the central one is this teaching of emptiness, which is the topic of the whole seminar, really. So here's one way. I'm just going to leave you with this today as a way of sort of starting to explore this a little bit. So emptiness is maybe not the best English word. Maybe there is no good English word for what they're trying to get at here. Emptiness sounds to us like something's missing, coldness, voidness, you know, zero. So another possible translation of the concept that they're trying to get at is boundlessness. Is boundlessness. So you could rewrite or reread the whole sutra instead of emptiness, boundlessness. So having no edges, no boundaries. We tend to think, I am here, here's the edge of me, here's the boundary of me. Is that really true? Are there really these distinct boundaries between me, my ideas, you, that cushion, this object, the snow? So what if form is boundless? What if boundlessness is form? Can we soften our sort of hard conceptual edges, which stick out like knife blades into the reality of our life? And hurt us, and hurt others. And we all know this, right? We all have experienced these ways that wisdom as a rock, wisdom as a boundary, knowledge, self-identification, me. The Buddha talked about me-making and my-making. We're always making me, making me, making me. So the central, the root of this teaching on emptiness seems to be, are you so sure that there's a me with an edge there? Can that edge get softer, more porous? Let more in, let more out. And that's why the Zen, you know, the sort of great, our great Zen ancestors figured out somehow this practice experience called Sesshin. There's something about the way we're together today. And we're together like this all the time, but we can see it today. Rubbing shoulders in a certain way, doing the same practice today, sort of like as one body, breathing, standing, walking, eating together in the same way, that softens those boundaries. And so it's not just an idea, there's an experiential training here, which seems to be a big part of Sesshin and a big part of what the Heart Sutra is trying to tell us. So it's not trying to deny the existence of our eyes. It's trying to say, when your eyes see something and you generate a concept, are you so sure that's what it is? Are you so sure that's all it is? And how quickly we identify things and dismiss them, right? We can watch that in meditation. Because we know, you know, we know what Dave is. We don't need any more information. One glance and we know everything we need to know, right? We're on to the next thing. Is that really true? And so Avalokiteshvara said, you practice softening these concepts, and he especially highlighted the concepts that make up me, That's what the aggregates are, the concepts that make up me. Then you will release, and there will be freedom. And there will be freedom from fear. So each of us has to find our own way in this territory. And that's our question. What is the next step for us? You know, what's the central point? What's the heart of the matter? What's the most important point? To find whatever this true life is, without fear, without boundaries. So, one more poem. Now that I've muddied the waters, let's do another poem. So the poem, Derek Walcott, and then we'll close. So the Derek Walcott poem I was going for. Thank you very much, Cooks. But I ran into that beautiful one about the sun. And yeah, we've read this one before, I think. Love after love. Love after love. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, "Sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life." So this is about identity, right? The time will come with winnellation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror. Each will smile at the other's welcome and say, "Sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you have ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life." So that's our intention, really. In Zazen. Sometimes it's hard. But to open to the possibility of a joyful reunion with our own self. Thank you very much.